Always Record episode 128 with guest Nicholas Ulbrich.
Hey.
Hey, Nick.
How are you?
I'm doing great. How about you?
I'm good.
If you want to stay on video, you're welcome to. I never put it on, but that's fine.
Okay. How come you never put it on?
Correct me if I'm wrong. Doesn't it take up more bandwidth? Doesn't it slow the connection down?
It can, yeah. We've experienced it before. I mean, but it's okay if one person's doing it.
Yeah, I like looking at your face, Nick. It's fine.
Yeah, it's good. It's for conversation to see what people's reactions are. Yeah, it's good.
But I like to hide behind a veil. So, but I'll give you a sneak peek at me, actually. We'll go tit for tat just for a minute or two.
Okay.
So thanks for rearranging your schedule to come on.
Oh, that's fun.
Yeah, I appreciate it. Bill might join us a little later, but he's at some family thing and he's running late, so maybe he'll come, maybe he won't. And then Alan and Kevin are both working, so they both wanted to be here for sure, especially Alan. He's wanted to talk to you again for a while. Well, although maybe you talk to him regularly. Are you helping him do the next synchronize?
We haven't spoken about it yet, but I'm keen to catch up with him at some point soon, so we'll get it happening. But yeah, I've got a few ideas for that. I had ages ago. Do you remember when the Oscar Pistorius thing was happening?
Say again? The what?
The Oscar Pistorius, the South African Paralympian who was done for shooting his wife in the bathroom.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, so I had this whole sync thing going on where it was going to be like looking at, because he was called the Blade Runner, right? And so I was like this whole thing about how the movie Blade Runner by Ridley Scott was originally cut for the theatrical release, so it didn't follow to what he had planned or the vision that he originally had. So then years later he did a director's cut, but now it's like if you talk about Blade Runner in the popular culture, especially to younger people, they're going to think of Oscar Pistorius. But what was interesting is like the way that he described the whole, his defense for the trial was that he was unaware or that someone broke in or something. But she was shot in the bathroom. So there's this film by David Lynch called Lost Highway. And in Lost Highway, there's a scene where he comes back from playing, is it saxophone? Or trumpet or something, some brass instrument, and then his wife is Patricia Arquette, and then there's this weird scene where he like sort of disappears down the alcove to where the ensuite would be, and you don't really see what happens, but apparently his wife dies. So I had this whole thing planned to do like Blade Running down the Lost Highway, but I never finished it. I don't know. So much shit has happened this year, like.
Have you seen the Jake Kotza film about Patricia Arquette, about hair? It's called Hairpiece.
No.
Highly recommended for that particular rabbit hole, yeah. Hairpiece.
What's the focus, David?
He does his thing, man. He just goes from deal to deal. He shows the repeated instances of her being associated with hair, but the meaning behind hair, that just meditating on hair, basically. But I wouldn't do it justice to communicate it. I was just learning if you'd seen it, but yeah.
It's like brings up to mind like the musical, is it called Hair? And but then also the Warren Beatty film Shampoo.
if Warren Beatty was running for president, man, he'd have my vote, dude.
I thought he was. Isn't he Donald Trump, Warren Beatty, or the same?
No. It's a big difference, bro. Warren Beatty.
Wasn't there a movie where he was running for president with, like, Halle Berry?
Yeah, that was a thing. What was it? Forward. But yeah. The thing is that he, like, wrote that. So it's Yeah, so it's like, you know, that's his actual views. Those are some... I resonate with a lot of those views. But...
I'm not familiar with Warren Beatty's au revoir enough. Isn't it weird to think, like, back when Warren Beatty was a huge star, Jack Nicholson was just getting started? But, like, today, Jack Nicholson's not known for any of those films.
What do you mean? His early films? Or?
Yeah, like all the stuff. Like
before Carnal Knowledge and Five Easy Pieces and Easy Rider and Little Shop of Horrors, man.
Probably before Easy Rider, I would say. Like, you just, I don't know, maybe it's just here in the land of Oz. We didn't get them or something.
Oh, I didn't even realize you're in Australia. You're in Australia.
I am. I'm.
You don't mean New York.
Sorry?
You don't mean New York. We have a whole thing with NY and OZ being each one letter removed, like HAL in 2001 is from IBM, you know?
IBM. Yeah, no, exactly. But that's the funny thing because, like, we have here, it's AUS is our country code for Australia. Mm-hmm. So, like, if you pronounce that, it's Oz. But we just abbreviate it to OZ. So we abbreviate everything. So like one of our national lotteries is called Oz Lotto and it's like green and gold coloring. Kind of like the Wizard of Oz with the Emerald City.
Sure.
I don't know. Like,
no, hey, yeah, we got a few people from Australia involved in our collective. Darren Brew definitely has brought a lot of things to my attention relating to Australia and synchronicity. I don't know. Do you know Darren Brew? Are you familiar with that guy?
No.
You guys like each other.
I'll have to get onto that. But yeah, you know what, David? I was like, I haven't done it for a while, but we had this cinema here, which you'll be aware of because what was it? One of the sync episodes, the Alan put up my recording from the 2001 Space Odyssey night that I went to.
I heard that. Yeah.
Yeah. So at this theater, they had like a Kubrick marathon. So they played all the Kubrick films and I saw them all there except for two. I missed Full Metal Jacket because I was too tired to stay for the double feature and I missed Eyes Wide Shut. But I did see The Shining there and I saw The Shining with your playlist, you know, American Dream and, American Prayer. But what starts it?
Wish You Were Here?
Yeah, Wish You Were Here.
Wow, you actually did that.
Yeah, but I actually did it in the cinema. It was amazing. And I got this whole Freudian spin from it. So it was like, obviously, Wendy is the superego because she does all the manual labor. Like, if you look at the film, there's no point in the film where Jack does any manual labor.
Sure.
It's all Wendy. So Wendy's the one actually taking care of the hotel, the Overlook. But then it comes down to Danny and Jack, and it's like, which one's the id and which one's the ego?
Mm-hmm.
And so you would think that, well, Danny must be the ego and Jack must be the id. But right. I reckon it's the other way around. I reckon Jack is the id and Danny's the ego, and Danny uses Jack. So it's kind of like this thing where you think that Jack is in control.
Right.
But he's not.
Yeah, you know, Mark LeClaire used to make the same point a lot. That basically when he's meeting Danny, what is it? Okay, so it's Danny Lloyd, and then he goes to the bartender whose name is Lloyd.
Yeah.
And so you know that he's playing a name game. See, it wouldn't matter if it wasn't for the fact that in the first place you got Jack playing Jack and Dan playing Dan. But then you have Lloyd, the bartender, gives you an indication that it's actually Danny who's like, you know, that's how visionary, he's like a, he can manipulate things, you know, he would manipulate situations. He leads him into the labyrinth. He killed him. And that's why, like, the whole, you know, my favorite part of that whole deal is I wouldn't have found the timing that I found with playing the end, the song, the end with The Shining, if it wasn't for those previous albums, including 13. And so it's at the exact time for me when I was running the experiment, when it was Wish You Were Here and American Prayer 13 with Crowley on the back, right? And then the end happened to end right when the film ended, and it tripped me out because, like, it's the syntax of my experience with it. But that was, like, the meaning. Like, when you see, like, it's like, Father, I want to kill you. He has this whole Oedipal thing all tied in. I didn't really catch that. And you can hear he says Duat in the song really loud, but it never shows up on the lyrics because it's just like a shout that he made, you know. But the Duat is the underworld. So he says that in the fucking song. It's really weird. That's why the West is the best, because it's the Western lands, right?
Well, yeah. But I'm not sure. And then so, like, I think in one of the episodes where you were speaking to Mark, he, like, did this thing where he listed off these books that he suggested that you should read. It was The 39 Steps by John Buchan, The Moonstone by Wilkie Collins, and The Moon is a Balloon by David Niven. So I read, well, what happened is shortly after I heard that episode, The 39 Steps kind of just materialized from my parents' library. So I just started reading it. And then I bought the other two in one of my book carts. And, when I finished reading The 39 Steps, cause it's a Hitchcock film, right? But we went, there's a local theater near where I live, and I just happened to be, while I was making a coffee or having breakfast or something, flipping through our local paper. I don't know if you guys get those, but we have this like local paper that's just for our district. So I'm flipping through it, and there's this full page ad for the community theater, The 39 Steps. So I'm like, no shit. So we went and saw it. It was like a comedic version of it. It was really funny. And they were playing on all the Alfred Hitchcock type references. So it's like one of the jokes was like, we need to get out of here, but the door's blocked. We'll have to go through the window. Which window? The rear window.
Probably get a rope.
yeah. And then there was like, oh my god, look, it's Superman. No, it's not, it's a plane. And then they're like, it's the birds. And there was another scene where he's running across the stage and they're being chased by an aeroplane, as in like north by northwest. That was really funny. So then, yeah, so that was like a real sinky book when I read that. And the whole book, I don't know if you've read it, David, but the whole book is like, he just like goes from sink to sink following his way through the story. Cause he's just like, the main character is just this guy who gets caught up in the whole thing because he's like a rich layabout or whatever.
I've not read that, but it sounds awesome.
Yeah, it's only short. It's like, what, 110 pages or something. So it's pretty cool. And then the Moonstone. Well, see, the Moonstone's got this huge section in it with this like evangelical Christian, and I just could not bear it. I'm just like, what the fuck? I don't know what this book is. It was like this really exciting, interesting book, and now it's just become the most bland thing. But by the end of it, it really picks up again, and the ending of it is sensational. So, yeah, I'd recommend that as well. And the David Niven book, because, I don't know, wasn't David Niven in a Sharon Tate film or something?
Yeah, David Niven. Yeah, is that Eye of the Devil? He was the king? He's the Sun King.
Yeah, that's it.
Yeah, totally. That is sinky as all hell, yeah.
But I know, like, I haven't seen any of his films, and I know nothing about him. So I'm literally just reading it because Mark LeClaire recommended it.
Yes, I feel like that's the whole basis of Abbey Road is, I mean, obviously, here comes the Sun King, you know, that the meaning of that is actually directly referring to Eye of the Devil, which is directly referring to the Golden Bough. Eye of the Devil and The Wicker Man are essentially the same film in that they're reenacting the King Kill ritual to the max. You know, I mean, that's what those movies are. And so for Sharon Tate, for that to be her debut film with David Niven is pretty strange. Yeah. So I do a thing where I play Abbey Road with Eye of the Devil, starting it at Sharon Tate's title at the beginning. It's pretty strange.
I'll have to check it out. Oh, you know, good.
That's a major rabbit hole, you know, but there's like real basic things that like is just mind boggling. Like that iconic photo of Abbey Road was taken, ultimately the same, day, within 24 hours as the, Tate murders.
JFK. Tate murders?
Yeah. And so.
Time zone difference, and then it works out being almost to the minute or something, you're saying.
Well, it works out being that they're within a very close time frame, point being within 24 hours of each other. So they're, you know, it's essentially, it's right there, you know, but they're crossing a zebra crossing, you know, she's killed next to this zebra rug that she would pose with for, you know, regularly. And so there's this whole weird thing going on there. Yeah.
And of course, Paul's not wearing shoes, and the whole like zebra representing the black and the white and the race wars and all that.
Right, where there's the white Volkswagen Beetle right there with 28 if on it, right? Where they say right. 28 years old if, you know, whatever. But there happens to be four Volkswagen white Beetles in front of the Dakota in Rosemary's Baby in the scene where Vicky, whatever name is, the Playboy Model of the Year, Playmate of the Year for 1968, the year Rosemary's Baby was made, she lands on a Volkswagen Beetle in front of the Dakota in the movie. That gets covered in blood.
Out of it.
Yeah, so you have this blood-smeared Volkswagen Beetle with this dent, and if you look at the shots at all the different angles, you can see that there's actually three other white Volkswagen Beetles on the street. And so then to have, you know, Abbey Road to come out when it did, and you're looking at, well, if you're looking for clues and the symbolism, you know, you got this Beetle-Beetles, you know, connection. It's really weird. Actually, you'll find that there's another white Volkswagen Beetle when she's reading the fucking, who was it from, Wade, I think, is a cult book on how to kill. It's about witchcraft, but it's how to kill somebody using black magic, basically. And this thing took an article of the clothing. So how to kill somebody without being there is what Rosemary is reading in his cab. And if you look over her shoulder, you can see a white Volkswagen Beetle right before she reads the description of how to do that.
Pretty scary. Right. That is creepy. You know, I've never seen Rosemary's Baby as Rosemary's Baby. I've only ever seen it with the sync that we did.
Oh, cool. Thank you. Wow.
So I must have seen that like four or five times with that sync, but I've never seen it like as it is.
That's awesome.
So I actually have no idea what the story's about.
Oh, you can see it though. You can see the conspiracy. Yeah. If you know it's a conspiracy and everyone around her is in on it and the impregnation and all of that, I feel that, you know, the album kind of communicates it better in certain ways than the film does in terms of the what's actually happening, you know.
Well, like Glass Onion comes to mind as being one of the really strong sections of that. You know, like when he's like there at the dinner party.
Yeah.
And he's like looking into the glass bowl and they're singing about glass onions and that.
Yeah. Yeah, it's strange.
Did you check out my presentation that I did based on a lot of your work that I presented?
Okay, this is good. Now it's all making sense. I didn't realize that was you. Yes, I watched it. Yes, I loved it. It's things like that that made me feel extra bummed.
They
took my videos down, you know, and it was a bummer, you know, and like.
Yeah, what the hell?
Yeah, and watching that, like watching what you were doing, just, you know, really was like, oh, but you know what? Since then I've put them on, they're on Google Plus. Not all of them, but I've been re-uploading them there.
And they're in the Dropbox, yeah?
Yeah, they are actually in the 42 minutes, or, you know, 42 Dropbox, yeah. You have access to that, huh? Cool.
Yeah, yeah. Cause I'm, with the membership or whatever that Alan set out for me.
Nice. Awesome. Yeah, that soaks me out.
But I ran out of money, so I had to make some tough choices of who I was going to sponsor. Mm-hmm. I was like, oh, Always Record or Gnostic Media? Which one do I go with?
Were you collaborating with Gnostic Media for a while? What were you doing with them?
Never collaborating. Never directly. Like, I mean, I speak to Jan from time to time. He's on my Skype list.
I guess my question is, what do you generally think of the work that they do there? I mean, are they getting into anything? Do you think it's overly dogmatic at this point? If you're comfortable talking about it, you
Well, look, I mean, I just raised Jan's name as, like, not a joke, but, you know, like an in-joke because of what happened.
It's happened with a lot of people, I found out afterwards. You know, I have a friend who listens to a bunch of podcasts, and she was saying she heard two other podcasts where the same kind of thing went down. And one in particular where this guy has been doing fucking podcasts forever and has never gotten to a single like spat with a guest, you know, and it went down. And he was saying afterwards, he's like, I can't believe that happened. It's like, so that made me feel better.
Do you listen to the High Side Chats?
I have.
Yeah. Well, there's an episode of the High Side Chats where Jan's on, and the start of the episode is it Greg? Greg comes on and goes, I've never had to apologize for a podcast that I've recorded before, but I feel like I need to apologize for this one.
Yeah, it's probably him. That's probably who they're referring to.
Maybe. I don't know. Like, do you listen to Neil Kramer at all?
Yeah, I know Neil well. He was actually, I mean, I don't know him personally, but his work as far back as like 2010 was sort of like one of my gateways into esotericism and philosophy. I read his blog a lot when I was like had downtime at work, and I don't like that he's still collaborating with Red Ice. At the same time, he seems to have different motives based on what he's talked about with Jason Horsley, so I don't completely like shit on him for it, but it's like, I don't know. Anyway, go on. I do know Neil for sure.
Well, it's just he has this comment about, like, it's not just the work, it's the teacher of the work. So, you know, because he was talking about when he was learning guitar, and he and a friend went in with his cassette tape, and they played it for their teacher, and the teacher's like, yeah, that guy's an asshole. Like, you're not going to learn anything. I'm not saying Jan's an asshole. I mean, I just think that he, at this point, has... Well, I mean, like, we can go here and we can talk about it. Because, there's a few things that I'm, like, upset about. Like, what the fuck ever happened to Edward Snowden?
Right. Yeah.
Like, is that not supposed to be, like, the massive, biggest revelation? Like, you know, it was this big bomb that was dropped on the alternative media community. And we're, like, 2 years out from it. And I heard no one talk about it.
Well, it's our kid, like, man. We don't want to talk about it. We don't want to talk about what we've repressed and don't want to fucking, you know. I mean, people rationalize, like, their lifestyles based on, like, you know, like, whatever makes this possible is, like, they'll, you know, just kind of be like, accept it, you know? I mean, people don't, there's certain things that people just really are not comfortable with, like, completely glass houses, you know? I don't think they realize the full implications of that.
Well, what are you defining as the bomb? Because I would say that anyone that is in alternative subject matters would know that we've been spied on for decades, that what Edward Snowden had to say really wasn't so... incredible. It was incredible in that it made it available to a mass audience, but anyone who's investigated government surveillance knows this has been going on for a long time. So I guess, what do you mean by bomb?
Well, I guess the second part of what you say, of course. I mean, and like, if you've done any like reading of like John Taylor Gatto, I don't know if you know that name, but like he has this thing about the fleas, like when he was getting some award or something, and this kid next to him was getting an award, and there was some story about the flea circus. And the whole point of the flea circus is that you get them in a jar and you close the lid, and then you basically create a situation of learned helplessness. And
right.
once you have that situation, you can work out which fleas are best for which activities, and then you just manufacture it that way. So his whole stick was that he was the lid, being a part of the education system. So he had to quit teaching after he came to that revelation and all that transpired there. And like, when Tragedy and Hope did the ultimate history lesson with John Taylor Gatto, I was sort of involved in that a little bit and helping out with that. So that was cool. And I've sort of done a few things, for Tragedy and Hope along the way. And yeah, I mean, I have no affiliations. Like, I mean, it just depends. But there are now, like, I think we've got to a point, and to bring it back to the Snowden thing, I think it was, you could say, like, is it the revelation of the method kind of thing? In the sense that, like, oh no, now everyone knows. But does everyone know? Like, earlier this year, just the local news on the radio, like the, you know, pop headlines for the mindless masses, was going on about how Google records every single search thing. And I was like, yeah, no shit. Like, we've known about that forever. Like, of course they do. Like, what do you think Google is? Like, some benevolent, like, do no evil. Like, the subconscious doesn't recognize the difference between do and don't and can and can't. It just sees an image. So if your message is do no evil, all you're telling your subconscious is evil. You know, it's, I don't know, I love all that language game stuff. Like, I've got a list in front of me of, like, sort of the roots of theoretical aspects that I would like to use to sort of develop my ideas for, I don't know, things that I do with you guys, like little short snippets and, you know, if I ever get around to doing an episode of 42 minutes to help those guys out or whatever. But, like, the list is, like, Freud, Nietzsche, Foucault. I'm a huge Foucault fan. Hobbes, Rousseau, Montesquieu, which is this whole trip because I was speaking to a friend of mine who's, like, not a clairvoyant but gets, like, images. And so we were having this conversation. She's like, oh, you were French in your past life and blah, blah, blah. And we went down it. And, like, there's a possibility that, like, what she saw was, like, Montesquieu. So that would be cool if I was Montesquieu in a past life and, like, came up with the notion of, like, started a couple of revolutions. Wittgenstein, Esposito, Bordeaux, Badiou, Zizek, Jung, Joseph Campbell, Thomas Campbell, Kristeva, Levinas, Reich. Big fan of Reich. You know, like, I got onto Reich through Foucault because Foucault wrote The History of Sexuality.
Mm-hmm.
And then halfway through, and there's always been a Reich book in our house, The Invasion of Compulsory Sex Morality.
Mm.
So, like, I'd always seen that book and it, like, always fascinated me, but the covers for Reich books are so bland. So I never, like, picked it up. So I'm like, oh, I don't want to read neck.
Or usually we have that little symbol, you know, the arrows.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
It's like a uterus.
Exactly. So, but then I was reading Foucault because this was for a course that I was teaching at the time. So I needed to read it all. And you know, one thing, my friends call me the Transcendental Tangent General, the TTG. So let me bring it back for a second. This is like a tangent off a tangent, bringing back to an earlier thing. But what I will say in defense of Jan Ervin is that he's sort of popularizing of what they call the Trivium Method has been invaluable in a lot of ways and a very important. Because so much of what we do, like, the big question, and I think you'll appreciate this, John, is, like, what's the methodology? You know? And the Trivium itself is not a methodology. It is a tool to be used within a methodology, and I think that's where the conversation needs to be picked up and continue. But I guess that's where you talk about dogma. It's like what Thomas Sheridan said as an off quote, like, because he calls the truth in movement the truth up with an F. And so his whole trip about, like, you know, fuck the Truffer movement and, like, you know, he goes on about the people with the Trivium and, like, the thing is, if you're just going to use logical fallacies and, like, point out someone's logical fallacies and this and that, like, whatever. But, yeah, I guess it's, like, that whole thing. So,
well,
in the sense of the Trivium is useful. And so when I was reading Foucault's History of Sexuality, because it's so dense, I'm like struggling to understand it. And he has this whole section built on Reich. So I go and read Reich, unaware of Orgon, unaware of the bionics. Like, I knew nothing about Reich apart from that we had this book. And to be honest, I was scared of it because of Reich, Third Reich, Nazis.
Who's afraid of Wilhelm Reich? There's a documentary called that.
Really? Wow. Yeah. So I read this book cover to cover in like two sittings. Absolutely fascinating. But I got this whole thing, like, because, you know, Margaret Mead faked half her shit.
Right. Like,
and when I was doing my master's course, we had to do this like intensive on like research methods and we had to study Margaret Mead for like 2 weeks. And I was like, this person's so full of shit. Why are we still studying this?
You've been studying Fraser. Because they made the corrections afterwards. Like, they made adjustments to all of that shit to the best of their ability. Like, I mean, you know what I'm saying? In terms of anthropology, if you're going to get into anthropology, Margaret Mead is, you know, she's the one, right? But she's kind of full of shit a lot of the time.
Well, I think it's just because of the historicity of it. So she comes in with her, like, you can say agenda, whatever, like, it's the whole thing is, like, we're all going to have biases. There's no objective position. No matter what you're doing, we are subjective within the objective, subjective, objective experience. So what can you do? Like, ultimately, it's like that whole thing of, like, I was speaking to my personal trainer this morning, who's a shaman, and we were talking about, like, well, where is memory kept? Because there's this whole thing, like, I've got a lot of tension in my upper body, and it's because earlier this year my father died, and I think I'm still carrying some guilt from that.
You didn't kill your father.
No.
Sorry, I just came out, and I'm sure that I was realizing as I was saying it, oh, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
I'm sorry that happened to you, man.
I'll tell you the story. Look, basically what happened is he had a really difficult life because he had a mental illness and he had bipolar, but he was also quite narcissistic. And so when he was like being unreachable, he was really unreachable. And so towards the end, he had like some form of hepatitis, I think B or C, but basically it destroyed his liver and he got liver cirrhosis and then he died from that, like, multi-organ failure in the hospital. And it was like, even though we knew he had a terminal illness and even though we knew he was going to die, it was still like that morning to be woken at 5 and told, you know, you got to go to the hospital. It's the last time you're going to see your dad and all that. It was such a shock. And yeah, so, but it gets back to what Alan was talking about a couple of weeks ago with, like, different sections of your body carry different emotional events. So we track our emotions in our muscles and that. And it just goes to the whole thing of, like, well, this is the question. And this is the whole thing is, and this is what I'm upset about, because what are we doing? Like, what are we doing in the SyncBook community? Or what are we doing in the Gnostic Media community, or the Red Ice community, or the Tragedy and Hope community, or the School Sucks community, or, you know, the Shamanic Freedom Radio community, or Thomas Sheridan's community, Nocrone's community? Like, what are we doing? Like, you know, and throw a handful of other podcasters in that mix as well. I'm leaving out names like James Corbett. Like, at some point you got to question it and say, well, are we following the link? Are we just wanting to get that YouTube hit counter up, and is it just entertainment? And if so, that's fine. There's nothing wrong with that.
No, that's not it. God, I hope not. I mean, I'm sure it's like that to some people. Even to those people, I couldn't imagine that could be everything. I mean, there's got to be something behind it. I mean, even people who do the most fucking atrocious things are rationalizing it in some way, where they're relating to it as so this is what's supposed to happen, you know? I mean, for the most part, I don't know. I trip out on that. Like, I'm like, oh, splitting the fucking atom. There had to be some flip side of people feeling like, if you do this, then this other thing will happen, you know? Like, kind of like, I don't know. There's the Dionysian and there's the Apollonian, right? I mean, Apollonian literally is destructive, right? But they're both destructive in their extremes. It's like there's this whole dialectic that exists. I mean, I don't know. I feel like we're doing a lot of things all at once.
Yeah, exactly. But I mean, like, is it like, see, back in 2010, it seemed to me when I was first exposed to some of this that the idea was that it's kind of like you can use the Matrix metaphor and like stepping out of the Matrix and like waking up. And this is a phrase that I hate, because what does it mean to wake up, you know? Because at the end of the day, we just go back to sleep, and we need sleep. Sleep is how we repair our bodies. So it's like a...
yeah.
You know, and we need to dream, and we need to have that duality. So what is it? Like, in the sense of, like, they live as a metaphor as well, like, that whole trip.
Yeah, I mean, it's insomnia philosophy applied. They don't relate to it, like, you know, everything is still there, it's just you don't relate to it as such. I mean, that's what denotes, the different stages of samadhi, right? It's like, a further recognition that the description is not the described, right? That on all levels, like, just you know, the obvious, but like what that means. You know? I mean, we're representing something,
Exactly. And that's where like Jason Horsley's idea of the second matrix, you know, the matrix outside the matrix.
Sure, which was even indicated in the Matrix, which they never really continued on. Fucking when one of those squid things was coming towards them at the end of Reloaded and it like goes down, you're like, wait a minute, but how could he do that? He's outside of the Matrix. How the fuck? And they never.
Yeah. Well, I mean, there's so much to that. And then you go down the whole thing of the occult path that Mark Passio goes down with the second and third films and, like, the will and cause and effect and all that. But I just think, like, it's, like, to what it's like that push, because it's, like, we're tilting at windmills and we're chasing dragons when we go after, like, the Federal Reserve Bank or the Rockefellers. I'm like, yeah, this shit's important. And like, you know, what's happened recently in London? Dude, you guys up on this with the whole royal pedophile ring? It was a big deal on our news service over here, on our, like, on one of our major stations has an ongoing thing about, like, I think it was our Governor General's driver. I didn't watch it because I don't watch that show out of the principle of not watching it. But there was all the ads for it and all that. And, like, there was this big trip about, like, young people. Like 5 and 6 year old people taken to these places. And I was in the kitchen and my mum was watching it. She's like, this is just like all those David Icke books that I read and thought were bullshit. You know?
I mean, again, here's another like news story that we're pretending is a revelation or something, or at least for most people. One of my favorite quotes from Gore Vidal is that we live in, at least in the United States of amnesia, where we get a news story about something, human trafficking, 6 months goes by, I forget human trafficking even exists. Oh my God, a member of parliament or whoever was caught fucking a kid. Oh my God, this is happening, 6 months goes by. They forget. So this goes on and on and on.
Glenn Greenwald releases all the Edward Snowden shit, 6 months goes by, and right. No one's talking about it anymore.
Exactly.
It's just we're constantly distracted, and I think that even this happens in the alternative media. There's like so many conspiracy theories, and there's so many things that you can distract yourself with that actually turn you away from individuation, self-actualization. What other point is there to life? I can't find it. Besides, you are in your own skull, you are in your own life. To try to like wake everyone up or get some mass solution, then you're immediately giving yourself over to a hive mentality, and then you're whole process of developing yourself goes away.
There's real activism.
Well, of course there's, and I will never discourage activism from out there. I think we need these kind of this tension and these sort of dichotomous forces fighting each other to try to maintain on balance in that world. But I think there's other levels of perception, and that if we consider ourselves aware of deeper realities or whatever that even means, I think that comes down to the point where it's, how do you serve as an example, both in how you're thinking and your conduct? And are you easily distracted? Do you represent actually the mass culture? Because when the alternative media is only distracted by story after story and feeling like, oh, we have to wake people up, why don't you just slow down and actually see if you've actually woken up yet? Because I think a lot of people pretend they have, and it's a very comforting thing to say, I'm awake. I can see this is going on. Now I can evangelize to you. And politics has become an evangelical enterprise. Everyone's trying to preach to each other about what they should or should not.
Well, it's always been that way. And that's, I mean, for the most part, as far as I can tell, as long as I've been alive.
Sure, but it's like, that's something to be resisted. And that's in your personal life. I don't see how that's not beneficial. I don't see how that's, like, useful.
Well, that's...
And so I guess, like, what are we doing? At least for me, I'm trying to show people how to reflect on their own situation and their own thinking processes, and fix your own life, and fix and maybe serve as an example to people that know you and in your community. And that's the most you can do. Trying to like form these mass solutions is an immediate neutralization of whatever you're trying to do, I think.
Well, I think that we have to be fair, and we have to include the Sync book in this conversation as one of the alternative media proponents or propondents that is caught up in this. I mean, take the last episode of Synchronize with the what's black and white and red all over, the whole thing, and then the middle chamber thing that I mean, no one's immune to it. And like, I'm not asking for anybody to be immune to it. I'm not looking for a messiah. I'm not looking for a guru. And I think that was the thing when I say, like, in defense of Jan Ervin, it's just a shame that he sort of doesn't follow through as much, because isn't the whole point of using the Trivium as a tool, or what he calls the Trivium method, to distinguish, like, there's so many versions of it now, but, you know, isn't the whole point of it that anyone can say something to you and you can dissect it to take from it what is the important information? And that's why I bring the question, because I think this conversation, the always record ongoing conversation for, you know, however many years now that it's been going on, is one that hasn't really got too caught up in that stuff, you know, like it's, in a sense it has and in a sense it hasn't, because it really depends each week on who the guest is or what you're talking about, et cetera, et cetera. But I think at the end of it, we have to say, well, this is our bias. We are wanting to know what is the source of our consciousness, if that is what we're doing. And certainly that's what I take from it. But I think with any kind of ongoing conversation, there are two ways to do it. So you can have the tabloid way and you can have the sort of investigation way, in a sense, or the research way. But, like, you know, I hear so many people talk about, like, all the research they did, and then they refer to YouTube videos or Wikipedia. That's, like, that's not research.
It can, like, be if, as you're watching those videos, you're constantly pausing it to fucking check, cross-reference the shit that they're putting out there, see if it actually aligns or not. I mean, if I watch those videos, more than half the time I'm watching them, I'm fucking pausing it.
Like, what videos, David?
Oh, all sorts. Like, I was watching the, I watched a Sandy Hook documentary or whatever, and there were so many things in there that I just felt so unbelievable to me that I would, like, you know, pause the thing and check all kinds of documentaries.
You mean like the Sophia Smallstrom?
Yeah, ever since I watched, many years ago, Esoteric Agenda, which was like kind of a heavy duty, like a cold fucking, you know, classic documentary stuff thing, and like, I was like watching it. Everything in there, I felt the need to look up, and it gave me like a framework to draw from to consider, and then see it. Like, it's just, that's as exciting as anything you're going to find. It's more exciting to discover something, you know, and oftentimes, like, if something's even tweaked, it can be, it doesn't always even negate the thing. It can even enforce it, like, in a different way that wasn't expected or whatever. And that'll happen a lot. It's kind of strange, actually, the way that'll happen.
Yeah, but that's not the end of the, like, see, and, like, I fully appreciate that. And I think what you're communicating is on point. But at the same token, you can't call that research. You can call it a thread, or you can say, I got this lead, but you can't call that research unless you then go and verify it yourself. And, you know, verifying it takes so many different aspects. And, like, we can rag on the PhD system, and I'll be the first to jump on that bandwagon and say that school is this awful place where we're conditioned in various ways, you know, but then give it 20 years and I'll be as hypocritical as anyone else sending my kids to school. So, like, that's the whole thing, isn't it? We live in a society where we're shaped by culture, but we shape culture, and no man is an island. So the whole thing with, like, my story about Foucault and Reich is, like, I could have stopped with Foucault's references to Reich, or I could have gone and done a quick Google search, but I knew that I had the book that he was referring to, so I followed it up, and I went and read it, and then I went and looked at, well, was Reich telling the truth? And how close was Reich with Margaret Mead in terms of that kind of fraudulent anthropology? And I think that, you know, I certainly don't have anything to report here about either way of that. But let's take a different example with the moon landings and whether they were fake or not, and whether Kubrick faked them. Who's that guy?
Oh, Widener, Jay Widener.
Jay Widener, right? So, like, his whole thing is that
he's not the first guy to say that, by the way. Sorry.
No, I know. And, like, that's the whole thing is, like, my dad, when I was growing up, told me more than once that Kubrick was asked by Nixon to be a standby to film it in case something went wrong. Try and find that anywhere. Try and find that anywhere to verify it. You can't. So where did my dad get it from? Fuck knows. But, like, Widener's whole thing is that he read Fukunelli. So as far as I'm concerned, until I've read Fukunelli, how can I verify anything he's saying? I can say that's interesting.
Right.
And I've got Fukunelli on my shelf. I just, you know, with all the books that Mark McClellan says to read, it's hard to keep up.
Just great recommendations, though, true.
Oh, man, like, that's the other thing. Whenever I'm listening to a podcast, I'm constantly having to pause it, find the books that they're referencing, and, like that's my whole thing, is, like, I've spent way too much money on books.
Tell me about it.
But can you ever have enough?
No. I actually have been tempted to sell a lot of my books that I use for references, because they went up in value. You know, like, Wiser stopped publishing Crowley, and so you can sell books for more than I got them. And I must have, you know, over 40 Crowley books, you know.
Well, I've only got the Book of the Law and...
That's all you need.
Yeah, I've got a black one, black-covered one, and a red-covered one. Book of the Law and... I can't think. It's going to bother me now. I'll look it up and tell you. But it's like, I haven't even read those yet, you know.
Don't read the Book of the Law, because after you read it, you gotta burn it.
Do you?
If you don't read it, then you don't have to burn it. You keep it on yourself.
Why do you have to burn it?
Because it says to at the end of it.
Does it?
Yeah.
So if you buy two copies, are you allowed to keep one?
Yeah, if you don't read it.
Maybe I'll buy another copy as my burner.
I always get a few copies of Dianetics. A diuretic, so I can throw them in the fire. You know, we're doing that. Yeah, on fire, yeah. You know? Throw Dianetics on fire.
Did you ever hear my test that I did for Alan with that whole thing?
What, Repo Man? What? Or
yeah, no. When Alan was first starting up Synchronize with Andras, they did a call and they wanted me to put together something just quick. Just to test all my editing and all that, just to see where they wanted me to change things and this and that. Mm-hmm. And yeah, I did that whole thing about like diuretics and Repo Man. And it's like, you know, say you want a shrimp and then later on someone will pass you a shrimp and
that suppose whole thing. You're thinking about a plate of shrimp and suddenly somewhere out of the blue, somebody would be like, oh, shrimp, oh, plate of shrimp. No explanation, no point looking for one either. It's all part of the cosmic consciousness.
That's it.
What's interesting to me, so just to get back to Reich real quick and book burning, it reminded me of Reich again, because around the time he was in prison, there was a huge book burning campaign to get rid of his stuff.
Yeah.
And I haven't quite figured out if that had to do with the threat that his thoughts on sexuality were a threat to the powers that be, or his thoughts on energy and natural energies and the vital force.
According to him, they're the same thing.
No, I know they're the same thing, but I'm saying, like, what did the authorities read into it, and then why did they feel the need to burn the books? So it was one or the other.
But isn't it just like in Donnie Darko, where they're like, excuse me, I thought we were here for a parent-teacher meeting, not to censor books.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, I'm not sure that you're dedicated to Sparkle Motion.
I'm going to get to question your dedication. The programming.
But something interesting in bringing up the burning, it's like, of course, there's the practice in ritual magic. If you burn your sigil or you burn something, it almost makes it more effective.
Oh, wow.
Do these mass burnings actually, like, who are they actually serving? So I guess for the short term. And it's
solve something for me.
Oh, fantastic.
Yeah, because that was the thing, because I've been going over my head over the John Lennon's statement about, you know, rock and roll being bigger than Jesus or whatever, and the fact that he referenced the Passover plot in connection to his explanation of why he said that. You know, he's like, I was very impacted by this book, the Passover plot, which is about Jesus faking his own death or whatever. But it was because of him saying that everyone was burning these Beatle records. But, like, I wondered if that was, like, a total fucking PR thing to go in reverse. But then the ritual side of it adds this whole other element, because that was the thing that was being imbued in the burning was the statement, which is like a statement for like New Eon, right? I mean, that's the whole Crowleyan thing. And so, yeah, I don't know. That tripped me out.
Yeah, no, if I wanted my stuff to live on in time, I'd almost invite it to all get burned. I mean, that's like the ultimate martyr thing, right? It's if you want to perpetuate someone's message or something, you martyr them in the same way you burn their books. So,
yeah, Joseph Atwell, speaking of, you know, the whole, you know, Nervine connection thing. I just read a great article that he just came out with about, the Beatles, about, Finnegan's Wake and John Lennon and all this crazy shit and like how it ties into his whole Caesar's Messiah deal. And it's weird because, I mean, I've been spinning with all of this stuff.
Can I just, just mentioning book burning and I was, and martyrdom and that. And I was just thinking, well, what about James Joyce with Ulysses and how you couldn't get that unless you were, it was like an under the table book and you had to like wear a big Macintosh coat to get it and all of that. Mm. And then as I was thinking that thought, I was going through to find what the other Crowley book was, which was Book of the Lies. So I got Book of the Law and Book of the Lies. But I was going through my order history and as I was thinking that thought while John was talking, I was looking at the cover of Caesar's Messiah.
Oh, really?
So, yeah, it was a bit sinky there. So I haven't read it yet, though. But, you know, anyway, go on. So this thing, John Lennon and Finnegan's Wake.
Yeah, well, basically, I mean, you'd have to see it. It's an article written by Joseph Atwill. My deal with it was like, wow, there's a lot of great information here. Yet it's not, you know, the standard of logic that they're, you know, looking for, I don't always see that in what they're presenting. Even like, especially Caesar's Messiah. I love that fucking book. I'm like, that is a great book. But like, and there's certain things that he establishes that are real points. The probability thing, mathematically, like what he's doing, he can back up. But what he extrapolates from it is total conjecture. And so to say, well, this is the formula to how I came to this, and this is why it's logical. It is logical, but I don't see I see A plus B equaling C, but then I don't see C somehow equaling B. Like, and he has this extra step involved. And like, and I saw it all throughout. I'm like, that is like how your interpretation of the thing, other people could interpret it differently. Like, he sees the whole thing as a satire. You know, the whole thing is a joke. I'm open to it being a joke too, yet it seems like, just like with the Old Testament, there's a lot of jokes that have deep meaning or whatever that are deeper than maybe the way that he's taking them, because there's all this other stuff on top of it. First of all, just to get into the biblical thing, I mean, it's a fucking song. Like, these are all songs, just like the Odyssey was a song, Upanishads, and, you know, a lot of Sanskrit songs, very similar kind of thing, you know, I mean, Bhagavad Gita is a song, which is very similar to the New Testament in terms of timing, that came out, some, you know, Krishna, Christos, whatever people talk about that. But it's also, it's numeric. Everything has its numerical significance, you know, some things way more than others, where it verges on like, how is this fucking possible without being intentional, which is the argument that he's making in the first place, you know, but he's not making it in terms of gematria. He doesn't bring up gematria. He doesn't bring up, the significance of Semitic languages and the crossover from hieroglyph and pictograph into English in there that I recall. I mean, but that's the thing. If you're looking at biblical texts, like, these are big components and a lot of meanings are conveyed and whatever, but it just feels like it's like he's got this part of something that is totally significant and relevant. And much of it is probably fucking totally true. But then it ends up speaking like this is all, what it all comes down to. And that's the thing that I can't hang with. It doesn't feel ultimately that logical to me. It's like, this isn't the point of the whole thing, which is my issue with like Jay Widener. Like, he's talking about Kubrick. Cool. That's a fucking interesting theory. But like, this idea that like it stops at your, whatever it is that you've come to, just feels kind of, not just arrogant. It feels kind of, ignorant to me, but, you know, or ignorant, I guess, more than ignorant.
But that was the beauty of Room 237. Because it takes Widener's theory, but it puts it in the context of a lot of different readings of the film.
It's a perfect film that way. It shows you all angles. You know?
So there's nothing wrong. And look, for all we know, Widener could be, or Widener, whatever his name is, could be absolutely spot on the money.
I think he could very well be spot on the money, at least when it comes to the footage itself. I don't know about the landing itself, but he doesn't even make that argument, which is what I love about Jay Widener. Is that he doesn't say that, you know, it means we never landed on the moon. All he fucking says is this footage looks fake. Who would be the most likely candidate for doing that? Here are some possible clues that you can see in his work. It's very concise. It's very, that in and of itself feels very reasonable to me. But then to say that that's the point of the whole thing is what doesn't feel reasonable.
No, and how can it be?
How could
Because ultimately it's still going to be art, isn't it? Even if The Shining was Kubrick's confession to faking the moon landing. And, like, I think it's undeniable in one sense, because I studied critical film theory or whatever. Like, my honors thesis was on the Coen brothers when I went to film school. So there's that whole thing of, like, when Danny stands up playing with the toys and he's wearing the Apollo jumper, you literally see the Apollo rocket lifting off the carpet. That is literal.
Yeah, you can see it. It's direct. Yeah.
So that's not, it's like, if you're denying that, then you're just denying basic, you know, Thomas and Borbellian film theory, which is fine, but it's a different conversation at that point.
Well, it's the assertion of what the intention is artistically for what's being conveyed. You could just as easily say this whole thing is about Apollo and Dionysus, and that's why his father needs drink, you know, it's because he's Dionysus and you have his son as Apollo, you know.
Are they really go different? There with it. Because what's I always go back and forth with Jim Morrison. Like, is he Apollo or is he Dionysus? And
struggle in the thing for who's in control. And so we're supposed to go, that was Nietzsche's idea, was that we go through this flux. They're mutually interdependent. One will outweigh another at different times, but no one ever wins in Dionysus and Apollo. They just do play out this thing. And so it's just a movement towards coagulation and a movement towards uniformity. And that they're always so, and they're both necessary, which is why I think we have value in what we're doing. And we have, in many ways, we have a very Dionysian thing that we're presenting, because we're coagulating information, allowing it to be malleable, relate to it in different ways, kind of psychedelicize it. But at the same time, if that's all it was, that wouldn't be any good. That would turn to like chaos. You need the order. But if all it is order, then it becomes, you know, destructive, because order can't, you know. But like, I look at The Shining, I see that being communicated. I see this whole Greek tragedy thing playing out, you know.
Well, because if all it was order, then you'd end up with the Protestant work ethic, and you'd end up with that. That's why David Bell's book on the cultural contradiction of capitalism comes into it. Yeah.
You want to know the Occam's razor explanation for why Wilhelm Reich was so hated by the powers that be? He was the only psychologist from the Psychoanalytic Society to work with the lower classes. They had all these rich people that were getting this help, and he had like a clinic, and he was seeing just all these people. He had so many patients, and he had a very high success rate. He had like the highest success rate of any of those people. And so they fucking resented it. Like, you could see that. You know, I mean, Freud resents everybody, you know.
I mean, you could argue a lot of psychoanalysis. I mean, the bigger ones, even like Skinner, neo-behaviorism, and Freud were based on sort of bourgeois perspectives on how society runs and how people operate, which is sort of highly slanted. So,
but Skinner and Pavlov and all that, I mean, what they didn't work with people, they worked with animals.
Exactly. So,
rats and dogs.
Right. And of course, there's correlations between man and animals, but then there's sharp distinctions that they just choose to say are sort of transformations of these basic animal things. And so humans are no different than a dog or a goose or whatever. And I can't deny the importance of behaviorism. I like people like Robert Anton Wilson and Tim Leary and so on, and Tara Lee, who take that and say, hey, you can co-opt certain things from behaviorism and use them to sort of rewire your brain. But then the question is, then there's the other side of the equation, which is like the process psychology of Jung and the Gestalt people, Maslow and so on, where it's a process. You're constantly in a state of becoming. There's never a state of being, and you're moving towards this. There's the unconscious that you're trying to unite with. It actually is a real thing. So it's these two. I don't think you can ever be a true psychologist unless you engage in comparative psychology and measure all of them and bring them together into one larger thing, whether that's an answer or not. But psychology is just the modern form of occultism, really. It's just like, how do we measure people's psychologies and then transform them? So even psychoanalysis is like a form of suggestion that creates neuroplastic changes in people's brains, so on and so forth. But anyway, just, yeah, to get back to the question of why do we even see disorders, quote unquote, as pathological and so on, it's from a very narrow reading of the human psychology, because if you ignore 80, 90% of the population, duh, you're not going to see the whole picture. And that's what Freud and who we're doing.
And then you end up with that whole thing with, like, DSM. And, like, then it just becomes... Like, I mean, we joke about it with my friends in the health sciences. Is like, not that I'm in the health sciences, but we just... It's like the shopping list, you know? The DSM is just a big book of where to buy your drugs from.
Well, you know, at the very beginning of the DSM, it'll tell you itself. It's like if enough people exude any disorder in this book, then it's no longer classified as a disorder, right? So what are you looking at?
Yeah, but when does that happen? Like, it just gets bigger and bigger.
All the time. Like, that's the thing. So, I mean, we already have all kinds of disorders that are not included or communicated in the DSM. I mean, I would say, like, just our whole consensus kind of, like, way of relating to the world as, like, subject-object relationship. Like, I mean, it's like there's very little acknowledgement of what we actually know, like, all over the place. I mean, there's this, there's a reason why people are so easily fooled in media and everywhere, you know? I mean, there's mass dysfunction happening, as far as I can tell. But there's a neurosis that's not classified as a neurosis because everybody's fucking exuding it, you know? I don't know.
Well, just to tie it up on the whole Reich thing, I think there's a couple of ways we could go. I guess, like, the other issue that we haven't sort of touched on is that he was Marxist, mm-hmm. you know? And at that time, that was, you know, we had the Red Scares and that. So sure. That was quite... I'd say that had as much to do with it as anything else, and especially given that he was, as you say, becoming really popular. And what did they end up getting him on? Was, like, tax fraud for commerce over state lines.
Right, it's like the Capone thing where they charge him with fucking some bullshit because they can't cut him on the big stuff. But there is no big stuff in his case, really. I mean, it's
kind of... Well, I mean, the bion generator, the cloud buster thing, I guess you could say that is.
Okay, I don't know. Just if we're talking about Reich, it's like, for me, like, up to his break with the Psychoanalytic Society, I'm in full resonance. And then there's, like, this point where he got this following. It was like when he wasn't being respected and he wasn't being acknowledged, that was like the gold. And then it was like as soon as all these people were kissing his ass, and it a lot of his stuff didn't feel as,
authentic.
It wasn't as authentic. It wasn't as, you know, it wasn't based on the same kind of standard. You know, he dropped the standard and it was all about freeing it up. But it's like, okay, well, you're freeing up the energy in your body. You don't want to, like, free up your,
But then, let's take it to something different, right? So let's say if you had a novelist, like one of your favorite novelists who put out, like, 4 or 5 absolutely stunning books that you live by, right? Whatever. Mm-hmm. And then they write late in their life, they write some horse shit because they went through a divorce and their mortgage got foreclosed on and they just needed a quick buck. And so they just tuned out some bullshit. After they're dead, would you still, like, include that in their oeuvre and say, no, we have to read absolutely every book and take them? No, you wouldn't. You'd just dismiss it and say, look, I mean, there were circumstances why they went this way. It doesn't invalidate what came before it. And I think we can say the same with Reich. Is like, it's like getting back to that whole thing with the trivium. Is like, you know, we need to be able to stop and analyze and take from each text on its own what's relevant, dismiss the arbitrary, dismiss what's not relevant, and then go back and ask the questions and find the next set of clues. And this brings me to my next point, because Reich had a break with Freud, right? That was his whole thing.
Yeah, sure. Well, it was more like Freud had a break with Reich, but yeah.
Well, either way, they were working together and then they weren't. And then there's that whole thing, which I haven't been able to find any sort of evidence on, but is that whole thing is like, well, the question, was Freud raping women? Like, is that what the hysteria was? Was just a cover for basically these women who were being mistreated? And I can't find any sort of source material to back that up. But if that's true, and if Freud was really just, you know, running his clinics to cover up, you know, discretions of as you said, wealthy people, then could we extrapolate from that and say, well, you know, because Foucault had this whole thing where he's like, one of these days I'm going to have to read Lacan and figure out what this psychoanalysis thing is. But are you fucking kidding me? Foucault didn't know who Lacan was, even though they were both like the biggest names in French academia contemporary to one another. It's like, mm-hmm. Come on.
Yeah, it's like Yoko Ono not knowing the Beatles.
Yeah, come on. It's ridiculous. It's just an absolute joke. So there's question marks there. And it's like, well, why did Foucault lie? Why did he say he didn't know who Lacan was when it defies common sense? And especially given who Foucault was, there's no chance he didn't know. So then there's that question. Was it just ego? And was he just wanting to like be like, no, I'm the number one French academic? Or was it that he was deliberately attempting to distance himself from psychoanalysis? And I think in reading Foucault, there is a lot that builds on psychoanalysis. And I think that we can say that maybe he knew what was really going on with the whole situation with when Jung and Freud were working together. And maybe in that sense, he did want to distance himself. And that's why.
Where did you get this idea with Freud with women? I'm not familiar with that.
Yeah, that's interesting. I never heard that.
Oh, I really wish. I thought you'd said something about it, David. I'm still trying to track it down. It's like one of those thousand thoughts a minute that I, you know, because I listen to so many different podcasts, but it was definitely brought up somewhere. And it's that whole thing that the hysteria isn't hysteria, because a lot of his patients, the women, were like naked in that. As right. A part of therapy. It's conjecture. I'm not saying it happened, but I'm just saying, isn't it interesting as a possibility? And then we connect it to this other interesting idea of, like, why did Foucault lie? It was the whole thing.
Yeah. Well, you know, Patrick's got this friend who analyzes Paul McCartney quotes. And basically, he does a thing where he puts Paul McCartney on the stand. And he'll literally just do it with quotes, where he'll ask him questions, and then he'll have places where he's answered it. And then he'll say, oh, but on the evening of so-and-so, and he'll have it actually there, you know, this is the reference, you know, this is what he said. And he'll not just contradict himself, he'll catch him in lies, and he'll do it over and over again. I wish I could remember the name of the site where this guy does this, but it's just very interesting to see the specific places in which they lied. You could do that with a politician, you know. You could do that with anybody who likes to lie, but it's really funny.
Too easy with a politician.
Why do you have to lie about this? Like the evening where he got into the accident on his moped or whatever, you know, and he busted his tooth, you know, and you can catch him in obvious lies there. He's like, oh, well, he describes the whole thing. He's like, oh, the moon was so full, you know, and you're like, oh, well, you said it was this evening. How could it be the night of this new moon when you say that the moon was full? And you say, oh, well, then. It was the '60s and I got it mixed up or whatever. It was a little later. It's like, no, but later your tooth was chipped, like before the next full moon. So like that story is just gonna be full of shit. But it's like, you know.
Here's the problem with me taking that too seriously, because we know from even like people taking a stand as eyewitnesses to murders and putting people away for decades that they were totally wrong. That people can be so totally convinced of seeing something or feeling something that, I mean, human memory is an extremely fallible thing. So for me to like say, oh, Paul McCartney is intentionally lying, or his quote unquote imposter Paul McCartney is lying. No, it's just human memory.
Well, there are certain times where
I don't know about. I think that's a very subjective opinion. I don't know if that's true.
Well, no, I mean, it just, if you went through it yourself, you'd see that there's instances where he's repeated something so many times and it changes. Can you count him in lies? That one, you could argue that he could remember it differently, what the moon was. I mean, but you take a certain example, as it, like, you know, I had never met this person, and then there's a picture of him with the person, you know, it's like, and is it him being mistaken that he never met the person? Then it's like, oh, they did a fucking project. You know, I mean, it's just like, there's things that are just like, really, like, you know.
Sure, I get what you're saying.
What I do know is that there's definitely something to it, you know.
I'm just saying we have to be careful, really, really careful.
Definitely. Sure. And just to back up John's point, it's like, as I said, I was teaching criminology. And one of the things that you learn when you're teaching, like when we start criminology first year students, is that the absolute fallibility of the eyewitness test. In fact, the only way that the eyewitness test is reliable is if you already knew the person that you're seeing. Otherwise, like, all the minutiae of the detail, like, just think about this. I don't know if you guys are with partners or what the situation is, but you will have been in situations where you're with someone and then suddenly in a crowd you get separated and you're like, oh, have you seen this person? And they go, what are they wearing? And you just go, fuck. I was just with them, and now I can't think of what they were wearing. Like, I mean, if you can just think how common that experience is, then months later, if you're on the stand, how are you going to be able to... I'm trying to add Alan to the call. Months later, how do you recall precisely what happened? And it gets back to the point I was saying before, like, where is our memory actually located? Because it's not in our mind. What the fuck is our mind? And that's why I think this whole thing, and that's why I went on that thing before, and we might have to come back to it now that Alan's on the call, but that was the whole thing. It was like, where is our memory? Is it even in our bodies?
I don't know if you guys realize, like, he's literally saying, this is why I got into an accident. So he's literally saying, I was distracted by how bright the moon was. And I'm like, then the time in which the accident happened, it's the furthest it could be from that. So it's like, you're literally telling me that the whole reason that this fucking happened was a complete fabrication, which is possible too. The motherfucker hallucinated. I don't know, you know, but it's just like, it's interesting. I like that there's people out there that are following people's lines and seeing where they don't line up, you know,
I'm not saying there's no value to it. I'm saying, like, to come to any hard and fast conclusions and then create this whole narrative about, yes, this is definitely the story. Oh. And Nick, you've written a whole master's thesis on conspiracy theory about narratives and the stories we tell ourselves to just make sense of our reality.
No, I mean, you should meet some of these people. They're very impressive because they got over 1,000 people, you know, that are.
I'm not saying they're not.
It's just, you know, you got like 1,000 people all jumping on this thing. And then they're like, oh, so you guys are saying Paul is dead. And like, they're like, oh, the thing is Paul is dead. So like, that's what everyone expects. But the people have been working on this for fucking, you know, 30 years are just like, no, I'm not telling you that. I'm saying everything for me at this point points to that there was a double. But I don't even know. Like, these people I appreciate their approach because they're not telling you this is what happened. There's nothing fucking fanatical about it. I'm sure there is in some of them, but like, for the most part, what I've seen and have been very impressed by, it's actually kind of refreshing when you think you're going to go to a conspiratorial side of Paul McCartney being dead, and you see that that's not even what they're even focused on most of the time, you know?
Well, no, and I think that now we're talking across terms, because I agree with the point that you're communicating there, David, in the sense of, like, you can, and definitely with Foucault, it doesn't even require that much effort. I mean, in terms of if you were going to go back and find all the psychoanalysis that he uses in his work, if he even uses it, but he builds on Nietzsche's genealogy project and that whole thing. And so is Nietzsche like that different in his work than Freud was? Maybe you could just say it comes from his Nietzschean references in the sense that Freud used a lot of mythology to build his theories and Nietzsche did the same thing. So they're two different. I'm not saying Nietzsche and Freud were connected, but I'm just saying it's a similar.
No, they met each other. They met each other.
Yeah. So
they had a whole connection for sure.
Yeah. So maybe that's it. And maybe he genuinely didn't know who Lacan was, but it just seems to me like a fabrication given who he was and given who Lacan was. Lacan was on fucking TV. Like, give me a spell. But I did want to ask you a question because you mentioned before about, given that we're talking about Paul not wearing shoes in the Abbey Road thing, Paul is dead. Well, there are two things here. Firstly, I don't know if you saw recently, but the Australian cricket team's in England at the moment playing a big match. I know maybe you guys don't follow cricket in America, but there's this thing called the Ashes, which is between England and Australia. There's this massive 5-test series. Like each game goes for... each game goes for 5 days, and then sometimes they don't even get a result. It ends in a draw. And cricket's a weird game. But the commentators for the Australian crew went to Abbey Road and recreated that thing like 2 weeks ago. Mm-hmm. So that was funny. But they didn't have the cigarette because it's not PC to have a cigarette.
Oh, what?
Yeah. But The other thing is, you mentioned about the 28 on the thing, the 28th.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm 28.
Oh, yeah?
So what the hell is that?
I don't know. It means you survived. You're not in the 27 club. Congratulations.
Oh, thank you. No, you know, like, are you into, like, all that, like, not numerology, but, like, specific dates when people are born in that?
Oh, absolutely. All the time, yeah.
Yeah, you know I'm born April 30th.
It was April 30th.
Well, isn't that, like, the quoted date that Hitler died?
Oh, is that right? Although Hitler, he went to the Alps, though.
Did he? I thought he went to Venezuela or South America.
Was it Venezuela? I don't know. They said there was that, it's some document, FBI document that was released over the referring to the release of Hitler, the allowance for Hitler to just do his own thing. And it was,
yeah, of course he did. What was he going to do? That man would have been absolutely shattered mentally and emotionally at the end of the war. Like, there was no, he's not Napoleon. He wasn't, right. They weren't going to exile him and he's going to come back.
Right.
He was fucked to begin with. So by the end of the war, he would have been an absolute wreck. Like, sure. Of course he went and lived a sad life at the end of it. Probably with a lot of them. And like Operation Paperclip and the Odessa file and the Ypres file and all that shit. Like, give me a spell. But sure. Do you know, like, so here's something we're talking about before, right? And the whole thing with like the depth of certain communications. And this is like, why I ask the question, like, why are we here and all that? Because, like, ultimately, it does come down to this idea that we speak a language, and that language is what we use to couch all our thoughts. And this is what is so interesting to me about Wittgenstein and, like, language games and all that. Like, because, you know, the film about Wittgenstein, and there's, like, that scene where it's, like, if you could talk to... Oh, sorry, I got distracted. Alan's asking about Paul and the 27 Club, and did you mention Paul playing with Nirvana in place of Kurt, 27 Club member?
The 27 Club member, wouldn't you? Oh, you're just saying because Kurt died Cobain, at 27.
Kurt Cobain was a member of the 27 Club, and Paul McCartney played a bunch of shows with Nirvana, obviously, right, in place of Kurt Cobain. So your idea of Paul... in the 28 and escaping the 27 Club, I think it's interesting that Paul or his double or whatever you want to call it, but the man we know is Paul McCartney playing with Nirvana. Totally. That's where I came into the call and you guys were talking about 27 Club, Paul was dead, and I just wanted to know if you had mentioned that already.
And let's not forget that Mark David Chapman's whole thing was that he was writing the 27th chapter of Catcher in the Rye by killing Don Lennon. So there's a kind of a weird connection there.
That book is weird as.
Catcher in the Rye?
Yeah.
Catcher in the Rye is shrouded in shit because that guy was a military guy, and I've tried to find J.D. Salinger's military background, and it's kind of difficult to see what the actual deal. I mean, it could be nothing, but it's just kind of weird because I found out that there was a book that he didn't want released till I think it was like 2025 or something that he had written, The Last of the Peter Pans. And I looked into it and I found out that though the book has never been published for the public, it described this whole thing where it was suggesting that in Catcher in the Rye, when he's stopping the children from running off a cliff through the Rye, that is actually symbolically representing kids going off the war to die. And so that was his whole thing, is that he was actually stopping the kids from the military.
Yeah, because it's so subversive. But then you get into all the different layers of it, like the sexual molestation layer and all that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, what's going on there.
Right, but, which is why in The Shining, fucking Wendy is sitting there reading that when she first shows up, you know.
Well, did you hear my response to, was it, not Skeletor, who was it that did the whole ear rape thing?
Oh, Violator Hellspawn.
Violator Hellspawn. Did you hear my synchronized piece response to that?
Oh, did I miss the synchronized thing? Maybe. Yeah.
Did you publish that, Alan? Is Alan still here?
I'm here.
It was one where I was talking about, like, censorship and, like, why once the material's already explicit, then that whole thing of political correctness is no longer applicable. So you can start those conversations like family incest? and like, so we can begin the conversation, but we need a space in which to begin the conversation. And that's the merit of pornography, because the pornography itself is so explicit that you can't help but be reminded of the fact that you're masturbating to a glossy piece of paper.
Good point.
Well, you can't, and especially then, you know. It's a little bit more difficult now with the internet and, like, the whole hypercube dimension of what we do with YouTube and whatever, but in terms of when The Shining came out, and, like, Playboy. And, like, remember, like, people go, oh, I only read Playboy for the articles. And you got to wonder how much that's exactly true. Yeah. And is that predominantly for a homosexual market?
I don't know. It says the selling David's soul. Why do parents molest their children?
Yes, play girls. Yes.
Yeah, because isn't that the whole thing where, like, Jack is seeing his latent homosexuality, and that's why he's trying to kill his kids?
Suggest that, yeah, but that was the thing that it's interesting that you'd read that in The Catcher in the Rye as well, because she's reading that fucking book, and the film itself is named after Instant Karma, We All Shine On, which is set at the beginning of the book by Stephen King. You know, right. It was originally called The Shiner, but then that was considered racist, which is interesting because the person to die in The Shining happens to be black.
Wait, how is Shiner racist? I've only heard Shiner as like a black guy.
No, they say like a shoe shiner. And so that was the original title of Shining, was The Shiner.
And then, Shiner also means piece of shit.
Well, they were told that he couldn't have it. The explanation that Stephen King was given for why he couldn't call it The Shiner was because of a racist element, which then I thought was interesting. That, because, you know, the two girls, it shows that they died, but everything is ghosts in The Shining. The only actual person to get killed is, Ullman, what's his name? Scatman Crothers, whatever. I should know that at this point.
Dick Halloran.
Come on, David. Come on,
Jesus
David.
Christ. Oh, that's just where I'm at, man. A little hazy. You know,
lift whatever. Your game, man. Lift your game.
So, you know, but then you have, and Jack himself. They're the only two people. So you have.
But does Jack die?
Well, he's frozen at the end. I mean.
But does that mean death? Does that really mean
death? Hence the photograph, you know? I don't know.
Well, that's the whole thing with the photograph. Because a photograph is a frozen moment in time. So isn't that the whole thing? It's like he's frozen in time. And that was the whole thing with, I've never been the caretaker, you've always been the caretaker. When it flips on him, when he gets is it vermouth on his jacket? And Grady's avocado.
Yeah, there you go. Thank you.
And Brady's wiping it off. And there's that whole thing. And then
Nick, you know, you kind of bear a resemblance to Grady.
I have never borne a resemblance to Grady, sir. I think you're mistaken. it has always been you who bears a resemblance.
Oh, no.
So when you mentioned him being frozen, the photograph, remember the hotel was on an Indian burial ground. So we have this idea of like this, you know, sort of stereotype of the Indians believing that the photograph steals your soul.
Right.
So is him being trapped in the frozen moment in the photograph, is that him being trapped in the Indian burial ground?
Well, maybe he was just looking for the Donner Party. Who knows?
I had that thought before. Like the whole stealing your soul with a photograph thing within The Shining. I've tripped out on that so much. But now at this point, I have this whole weird relationship with July 4th and its relationship to Sirius, right? That's like literally like an Egyptian holiday, so to speak, you know? It's a high holy day. And so, I mean, there's more to it than that, but there's definitely like this whole thing with the initiate. It's like, oh, this guy, this, to be, you know, to be eternal and what qualifies as that. But then it has this whole thing regarding fame that I relate to like Babylon, this whole deal, you know? But yeah, to take the picture and to steal the soul. And then just the idea that you're making a film is like, you know, that's what you're doing.
Is that right?
It's 24 stolen souls per second.
Wonder I can think at all. Listening to this broadcast from the SyncBook Radio. If you enjoyed this episode, there's so much more content waiting for you at thesyncbook.com. Tune in to our other SyncBook Radio programs, 42 Minutes, Always Record, The Marty Leeds Math Magical Radio Hour, Synchronize, Pentimental, and Sync Quick News. Our newest episodes are always free, and members get access to our full archive of over 600 hours. You'll find all of this, as well as our books and videos, at thesyncbook.com.